Dodgers last night to advance to the NLCS against the Cubs, Game 1, Saturday night in New York. The ALCS between the Royals and Blue Jays starts tonight. NFL Thursday Night Football, New Orleans beat Atlanta 31-21. Coming up on Sunday, the Bears play Detroit at noon. The Packers play San Diego at Lambeau at 3:30. The forecast now from the National Weather Service, mostly sunny, breezy, and cool. Today's high 49. Now 43 Racine, 41 Kenosha, 38 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from the Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Well, I'm sure many of you recognize that iconic theme music of Alexander Courage from Star Trek, the original series. But something may not have struck you as quite right or exactly as you have heard that before. That was not the voice of William Shatner, who, of course, portrayed the role of Captain James T. Kirk in the original Star Trek series. Rather, that was the voice of actor Victor Mañana, who portrays Captain James T. Kirk in an absolutely extraordinary project, which sustains the original series beyond the limits of its original three seasons. This web series is called Star Trek Continues. It's one of actually several efforts by fans of the series to create, in a sense, new episodes that extend the life of the original series. But nobody has done it better than Star Trek Continues. In fact, no less than the Wall Street Journal called it the flagship of fan-produced films. And it is extraordinary the extent to which they have managed to recreate the look and the feel and the spirit of the original program. I mean, if it weren't for the fact that you weren't actually seeing William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly and the other original cast members on the screen, you would swear that you are watching something from the original series. I've never seen anything like it. There are five episodes, and they are hoping that there will be many more yet to come. And we're going to be talking with the man who not only portrays James Kirk in Star Trek Continues, but whose brainchild, really, Star Trek Continues is. He wears a number of different hats in the production and crafting and polishing of these episodes. He is executive producer of Star Trek Continues. Vic Mañana, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's such a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Well, I'm truly excited about this. Whenever we get to talk about Star Trek on the morning show, it's an exciting, fun day for me. And I should mention that you have had a career in theater and film production that has kind of taken you all over the map. And in particular, you've kept very busy as a voice actor for various animated series and video games and so on. And maybe much more to the point, you have been a a tremendous fan of Star Trek for a long, long time. Let's start with where that began. What was your very first encounter with Star Trek, the original series, and at what age were you?
Well, Greg, to be honest with you, I credit the original series of Star Trek with having literally jump-started my creative energies. When I was 9 or 10 years old, I discovered the original series, and I would rush home every day from school and plop down on the floor in front of my 19-inch black-and-white television. And not only would I watch the series, would I watch the episodes intently, but I would also put a cassette player, cassette recorder, by the speaker of the television, and I would record the episodes on audio cassette, and then I would put the cassette player under my pillow at night. And I would lay there as I went to sleep and listen to the original episode. And when I say that I credit Star Trek with jump-starting my creative energies, because to that point in my life, I had never built anything. I had never made anything. I never had any real inspiring desire to do some of these creative things. But Star Trek made me, I wanted to build phasers. I wanted to try to make a communicator. I got my mom to teach me to use a sewing machine so I could make my own uniforms. I wanted to write stories. I took my family's movie camera and rounded the kids in the neighborhood up where I would use them as my cast and crew and make little Star Trek episodes where I was talking Kirk. And so a lot of the things that I do today professionally, acting, film production, sound production, prop building, set building, costumes, a lot of those things I actually tried for the first time because of Star Trek. So that gives you a little bit of insight into why this show means so much to me and how it inspired me.
So at what point did it occur to you that it would be possible and worthwhile to try to recreate, in essence, that original series? First of all, as I mentioned in the introduction, Star Trek Continues is not the only such effort, but it's without a doubt the best. Had other efforts already been done, and did you think to yourself, I could do that better? Or were you really sort of striking out on your own when you first got this idea?
You know what? You just took the words right out of my mouth. I spent a brief amount of time involved with helping some other productions, some other fan productions. And, you know, while they were nice guys and they meant well and were having fun making Star Trek, my immediate response as somebody who works in production professionally was, oh my gosh, this could be done at such a higher level. A lot of fan productions suffer from one of the biggest challenges, and that is acting. You know, they're fans, and certainly they love Star Trek, but they don't have any experience in acting and telling deeper stories, and they don't have maybe perhaps a ton of experience in lighting or camera work or editing or sound design, any of a number of areas where production can fall short. And so I walked away from these other productions thinking, wow, you know, if I could round up a group of people who were talented craftsmen in their fields, whether it be camera or sound or lighting or makeup or wardrobe or whatever, and actors who were good actors who could tell a deep story and could really, could really communicate dramatic themes. If I could bring all these people together that love Star Trek as well and want to do something like this, I'll bet we could do something really special. So I literally put my own money where my mouth was, and I personally paid to have the sets built and then to fly everybody down to the studio and put them all in hotels. And we shot our very first episode about 3 years ago called Pilgrim of Eternity, which was a sequel to an original series episode that featured the Greek god Apollo. And I put all my money and love and craft and skill into it, hoping that people would enjoy it, and they really, really did. And so at that point, we started making more, and it has just grown from there.
Let's talk right off the bat about what probably is maybe the most kind of bewildering question on maybe a lot of people's minds. But the question is it okay to do this? Specifically, is it okay with the folks who, in a sense, own Star Trek? And I'm not don't remember now if that's Paramount or who it is who possesses all of the copyright for Star Trek. Obviously, with something like this out in the world, I mean, I know that that at least one of your episodes has received well over 1 million hits on YouTube. So it's not like this is anything you're doing in secret. To what extent is this entirely permissible? Is this being done in cooperation with those who own the rights to Star Trek? Are there certain lines you must not cross? Explain sort of the legality of this.
Yes, happily. It's a good question. Actually, none of the Star Trek fan productions that you will ever see anywhere are sanctioned or licensed by CBS. But the beauty of it is that CBS graciously allows fans to make these homages and these tributes to their show as long as, and here is the big red line that must never be crossed, as long as you do not make money with it. You are not permitted to take their license and sell it. You're not permitted to, you know, to make a profit or commercialize their license. You know, George Lucas learned a long time ago that rather than pissing the fans off by shutting down their fan efforts, they were actually perpetuating his license. I mean, they were actually, by their own efforts, they were keeping Star Wars alive and well and surrounded with excitement. And so Lucas basically allowed Star Wars fan films to exist. Rather than sending his legal team to shut them all down, he let them exist as long as or until they tried to make money with it. And it's very important to us that CBS knows very well, as do your audience, that it was never our intention nor desire to make any money with Star Trek. We simply love what the original series was. We love what it stood for. We love the sensibilities and the style of storytelling, and we wanted to create more of that to the best of our abilities. This is entirely and completely a labor of love, and as long as nobody makes money at it, then CBS is very, very gracious in allowing us to do what we're doing, and we will not cross that line. In fact, it might interest you to know that I've had several offers from networks and even airlines wanting to put our series on their in-flight entertainment systems and online networks wanting to use our episodes. But my answer has to be, we can't make money. We can't have advertising connected to it. We are not about to risk damaging our relationship with CBS, because the most important thing is to make these episodes and share them with the world.
We're speaking with Vic Mignogna, who is responsible for Star Trek Continues. I mean, it is his brainchild. He is the executive producer. He portrays Captain Kirk in this fan series, web series, which perpetuates the look and the feel of the original Star Trek series to an absolutely mind-boggling degree. I mean, when you go on YouTube and look up one of these episodes and you begin watching, particularly anything that is set on the bridge or on any of the familiar sets, locales of the Starship Enterprise itself, it is hard not to believe that you aren't watching something from the original series, except that what is unfolding is obviously not an episode. It's a different story, but its sense of place is absolutely spot on. And beyond just the look of the show is the feel, the spirit, the principle behind it. It is a remarkable achievement. And it's great to be talking with Vic Mignogna about this this achievement. So let's talk for a moment about the gathering of others to help make all of this possible. What did you do first when you decided that you wanted to do this? Was task number one to do the building of kind of the physical stuff, or was it the gathering of the cast that would actually populate these iconic roles? Where did you begin?
Well, actually, those two activities were simultaneous. Obviously, it was going to take a considerable amount of time to build the set, and to get them to the place where they were ready to shoot episodes on. So that undertaking began, I believe, in 2013. And at the same time, simultaneously, I was talking with other actor friends of mine, as you mentioned, and I thank you for it. I'm a voice actor by trade. I've done a lot of stage. I've done a great deal of musical theater and some on-camera work. But the thing that I do most is voice acting work. And I have a lot of other voice actor friends. The gentleman that plays Spock, Todd Haberkorn, is a very talented, popular voice actor. Chuck Huber, who plays Dr. McCoy, is a very accomplished veteran voice actor. But they're not just voice actors. They are first and foremost actors. They have a huge background of experience and training as actors. And I had determined from the very beginning, if I'm going to do something like this, I'm going to get people that are actors. I'm going to get people that can really play these roles well and people that aren't afraid to go deep if the story calls for it. So while the sets were being built, I was simultaneously gathering crew members, cast members, dear friends, Lisa Hansel and Tim Vitito. I asked to come on board as our makeup supervisors, Ralph Miller as our sound supervisor, Matt Busey as my director of photography was one of the first people from a crew standpoint that I brought in because he's brilliant and amazing and one of my dearest friends. And he and I talked from the very beginning about studying the lighting style of the original series and studying the camera composition. And even down to the detail of presenting the episodes in 4:3 aspect ratio instead of 16:9, which is the standard now. So I was compiling actors and crew. I reached out to Chris Doohan, who, as you may or may not know, is the son of James Doohan, who played Scotty in the original series. And I asked him if he would be at all interested in playing his father's iconic role, and he agreed, and he is having the time of his life. And it's eerie to see him on screen because he looks and embodies so much of his father. Grant Imahara from Mythbusters, who was a good friend of mine, plays Sulu. And Kim Singer and Wyatt Lenhart round out the cast as Uhura and Chekhov. And all of these people have acting experience, and I feel like they really fit the roles well. And then we brought in some other people like Ginger Holly in Wardrobe and Casey Shasky as unit production manager and James Kerwin. And Mark Cushman, who fell in love with our episodes at the very beginning and contacted me and said, I'd love to work with you on script acquisition and script supervising. And Mark Cushman is the amazing, talented gentleman behind the book series, These Are the Voyages, which is an incredibly exhaustive look behind the scenes into the production of the original series. So we were building the sets at the same time as we were compiling cast and crew.
Progress report, Mr. Scott.
There is no progress, Mr. Spock. I cannot initialize this beastie without the captain's passcode. I've done all I can do.
Ensign, have you applied a brute force algorithm to override the device's lockout?
Sir, Deutrona consoles are designed to deactivate in the event of multiple access attempts. Starfleet protocol.
So the vast majority of people involved in this with you are people you already knew. I mean, it sounds like maybe James Doohan's son, and he is an exciting part of all this, was something of a stranger to you to whom you had to reach out. Otherwise, by and large, the people that are doing this with you are people you already knew, people you counted as friends?
I would say that's true. I would say, by and large, these are people that I had worked with in some capacity or another, and I knew of their abilities. And let me say this too, Greg. I've told my team this many, many times. I never wanted to make Star Trek Continues with strangers. I never wanted to make it with hired guns. You know what I mean? I wanted to make it with friends. I wanted to make it with people that I loved, with people whose abilities I was familiar with, and who I knew would do a great job. You know, we even created a new character. My fiance, Michelle Speck, is in her own right, an extremely gifted actor, a very, very amazing actor. And of course, when I started putting this together, I talked with Michelle, and we're like, what could you do? Who could you be? And we briefly talked about her playing maybe Yeoman Rand or Nurse Chapel, one of the other iconic characters in the original series. And then we started thinking one day, you know, Next Generation, which takes place 100 years after the original series, had a ship's counselor. In fact, all the starships had an onboard ship's counselor. And then we started thinking, well, when did they start that? Because the original series didn't have a ship's counselor. And so we decided that as we would move forward with the original series, that some of the things that were standard procedure in Next Generation might have had their start at some point in the future of the original series. So we created a new character named Dr. Elise McKenna. Dr. McKenna is the first experimental onboard ship counselor. And Michelle does an amazing job with that. And her character has, in my opinion, morphed in seamlessly with the original cast.
Mm. When you set about building these sets to be really what appear to be perfect recreations of the originals, did you have anything to go on besides just the look of them? I mean, poring over video, or did you have, in a sense, anything in the way of original documentation that could give you even more of a specific, tangible blueprint by which
to
construct this?
As a matter of fact, Greg, there are online blueprints from the original soundstage. You can find them, and you can see the basic diagram of Stage 9 is what it was called. Stage 9 and Stage 10 is where Star Trek was shot. Stage 9 were all the ship sets, and Stage 10 was the pod set. So you can find online a diagram of the drawing of Stage 9. Now, there's only one problem with that drawing. There are no numbers. there's no scale of measurement. However, our DP, Matt Busey, our director of photography, just happens to have a degree in architecture as well. And he took those plans, and he measured things that were standard sizes. For instance, if you know something is a 4x8 sheet of plywood, or you know something is 12 inches in diameter, there's a common piece on the diagram. The panels in the corridor, for instance, Greg. The panels along the bending corridor are 4x8 sheets of plywood, which is standard when you build. And obviously, they're not going to cut some weird, you know, take the time and effort and money to cut some weird dimension. So those are 4x8 sheets. Well, if you know they're 4x8 sheets, somebody like Matt Busey can extrapolate from that, and he can calculate the numbers of everything. He can calculate the size and shape and dimensions of everything. And so that's what Matt did. And then he exported and printed out plans with all of the numbers so that our volunteers and the people that helped build the set could look at these plans and go, okay, this is 10 feet here, and this is 15 and a half feet there. And that's why the sets look at least in my opinion, and certainly for the sake of television, you know, look as close to the original as they could possibly look. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, a massive amount of study on the paint coloring, you know, what are the paint colors of the walls and the carpeting, what color is the carpet here and there, and then all of the little details, the little plant-on pieces, the nameplates, the piping, the intercoms, the fabrics, all of these things. People like William Smith, who is our set coordinator, all of these things are essential to creating, you know, the look. But let me say something real quick, Greg, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fan productions get hung up on the set, and they spend so much time on the set to make them look really good, and in many cases, a lot of fan productions, the sets look great. They may even be more accurate than ours. But here's the thing. A person who understands production understands that the sets are merely a backdrop. They're just a background for the real essence, which is the storytelling. And, you know, our goal with making the sets accurate is so that when the image first comes on screen and the actor looks around the set, for the first 30 seconds, he goes, wow, this looks just like the Enterprise. This looks just like the original series. And they're wowed and blown away for about 30 seconds. And then they've accepted the setting that they are in, and now they're focusing on the actors, and they want you to tell them a good story.
And, of course, there's where the next phase of this undertaking goes, namely to fashion some stories that fall very much in line with the original series and what that series was about, what it stood for. And, of course, on a couple of different levels, you've done a tremendous job here of not only evoking the original series, but even of offering some very tangible continuity with the involvement of certain characters that people will remember from noteworthy episodes of that original series. Talk for a moment about the process of assembling these stories. I know that you had some hand in at least some of the fashioning of these stories, but we see other names in the credits in terms of screenwriters and so on who assembled all this. Tell us about that specific process and what was most important in assembling stories that would really ring true.
Well, Greg, I must tell you that finding really, really good stories may indeed be the biggest challenge of all. I mean, anybody can build sets, right? I mean, anybody can go to Home Depot and buy lumber and nails and paint and build sets. And anybody can sew costumes. And, anybody can, with money, can spend money. But finding good stories has turned out to be the biggest challenge. Star Trek Continues. I had purposed at the very beginning that we were going to tell endearing, thought-provoking, dramatic stories in the flavor of the original series. I mean, one of the reasons the original series is still so iconic and resonates even 50 years later, next year is the 50th anniversary, is because the stories were timeless. The stories were not necessarily about space battles or creatures. The stories were about the human condition. They were about ethical dilemmas. They were about moral quandaries. They were about social questions and challenges. And that's why they still resonate today. And those were the kind of stories I wanted to tell. So the very first episode that we did was a story that I wrote. And I brought a couple of my friends in and gave them the responsibility of turning my story into a screenplay. And they did that. They did it very well. And then I made some adjustments and changes to it to match my vision for the story. And it turned out good. And then the second episode was a story that my friend Houston Huddleston and myself came up with. And then we tasked someone else to write the screenplay based on our story. And then again, I would tweak the script and adjust it to match my vision. The third episode was my story. And my dear friend James Kerwin wrote the screenplay and directed the episode. And then the fourth episode was a story that I came up with our first AD, Chris White, and wrote the story. And then we gave somebody the story to script. And then again, I script edited. I made some tweaks and changes. And then the fifth episode, which is our first episode off the ship, was a story that I came up with a couple of years ago. And my dear friend Mark Cushman wrote, turned my story into a screenplay. But I find myself doing, Greg, very much what Gene Roddenberry did. From my understanding, and if you've read Mark's books, and I believe you have,
yes,
you know that Gene would get all of these amazing stories from these sci-fi writers and stuff, and then he would, in many cases, rewrite them. Or he and Bob Justman would do a massive amount of script editing on them to make them consistent with his vision for Star Trek. And the funny thing was, if you look at the credits to the original series, he often would not even necessarily take credit for everything he did. The original writers would still get credit for having written the story. But Gene Roddenberry was the script supervisor and script editor, and in many cases would, you know, make adjustments to the stories to tailor them to his vision for the series. And that's very much what I'm doing as well. But I want you to know, I don't consider myself a big writer, and I don't want to write stories. I don't want to have to be responsible for coming up with the stories. But we've received so many script ideas, and while they're great from a fan standpoint, many of them, I dare say most of them, simply don't have that special something. You know what I mean? They don't have that underlying theme. They don't have that underlying moral or point or a message to communicate.
Sure. Well, I think, and of course, it's probably important for us to say that fan contributions to the legacy of Star Trek are nothing new, that long before there was even an internet and YouTube or anything like it, fans have been penning their own Star Trek stories for a long, long time, and some of them have even been published. I mean, legitimately published, even collections of various kind of new voyages and new stories.
Absolutely.
Some of which felt like, yes, this could be an episode, and some of which sort of took the universe of Star Trek into very different places. And now, of course, we're talking about a legacy that has expanded into all of these films and follow-up series. And, of course, when a typical Star Trek fan now sits down and creates a story, they are creating it with all of those other influences in place. And it sounds like your guiding principle among above all others is of trying to be as true as you can to what the original series was like. And that's probably one of the trickiest things. I mean, for instance, younger fans for whom Star Trek is something else, maybe something newer or something bigger or broader, what they might conceive as story ideas would not really work for the vision that you have for Star Trek continues to really remain
that's
true
correct.
To its roots.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. Because, you know, Star Trek is not about Captain Kirk fighting the Klingons. And it's not about beaming down. It's not about flipping open communicators. It's about human stories and human challenges. And, again, that's what the original series was known for, and that is what has kept Star Trek alive for all of these decades. So, you know, my desire was to tell those kinds of stories, and I have found, much to my frustration, that it's a lot harder to find those kind of stories than I originally thought it would be.
You're listening to excerpts from the interview I recorded with Vic Mignogna, the executive producer and creator of the web series Star Trek Continues, which seeks to replicate as much as possible the look and sounds and feel and spirit of Star Trek, the original series. One of the most extraordinary achievements towards that end came with the first of the five episodes thus far created, Pilgrim of Eternity, which serves as a sequel of sorts to an episode from the original series called Who Mourns for Adonis, in which the Enterprise is imprisoned by a being which seems to be Apollo from Earth's mythological past. And in an extraordinary coup, Vic Mignogna was able to secure the participation of the handsome, strapping actor who portrayed Apollo in that original series episode, Michael Forrest. He came back to be part of this web series episode, Pilgrim of Eternity, nearly 50 years after portraying that iconic character.
Who Mourns for Adonis was one of my favorite episodes. And I, for those of you that don't know, the gist of the episode was that the Greek gods were actually travelers from space that landed in ancient Greece. And because they were so advanced and they had these abilities, the people worshipped them. And when they all left Earth, Apollo waited out in space on a planet for mankind to venture into space, thinking that once they came out into space, they would once again worship him as their forefathers did, and everything would be wonderful. And, of course, Kirk and his crew were going to have none of that. But when they defeated him, he left. When he disappeared, he faded away, and he was so sad and just brokenhearted. And I remember thinking, I wonder where he went. I wonder what happened there, you know. And so another Star Trek royalty named Barbara Luna, who played Marlena in the original episode Mirror Mirror, she played Kirk's cabin girl in one of the most famous episodes, Mirror Mirror. Barbara Luna and I are dear friends. And one day Barbara Luna said to me, you know, Mike Forrest would love to do a Star Trek thing. If you ever do a Star Trek thing, Vic, Mike would love to do it. And this was even before I even had thought about doing Star Trek Continues. So as I was putting the series together and trying to decide what to do with our first episode, I called Barbara Luna and I said, Luna, can you put me in touch with Mike Forrest? And she did. And I met him and I sat down at lunch with him. And I looked across the table from him and I said, Mike, I have an Apollo redemption story. And his eyes lit up. And he said, you know, I retired from acting a long time ago, Vic. I'm an old man now, but I would come out of retirement to do something like that. He was intrigued by the idea. And I gave him the script to read, and he enjoyed it. And so he and his lovely wife, Diana, came down. We flew them down to the studio, and Diana actually played Athena in the very opening scene where when Apollo reappears on the bridge, he reappears cradling the dying Athena in his arms, and she dies right there on the bridge. But he helped us launch Star Trek Continues in royal style, so to speak, by being a part of it. And the theme of the episode, once again, as we were talking about themes, the theme of this episode was the concept of self-sacrifice as life-giving energy. That giving of oneself to others and serving others is in itself a form of life-giving energy. You know, Apollo was gaining energy by people worshiping him, and so he thought that was the only way he could get energy and strength, was to force people to worship him. And the concept that we came across and wanted to communicate in the episode was that there's a better way. There's another way, and a better way, and that is to give of oneself, sacrifice oneself for the good of others.
It had to be absolutely thrilling for a longtime Star Trek fan to find yourself across the table from someone who had played such a memorable part in that original series. And I suspect that when you began all this, when you first probably hatched the plan,
Your thoughts probably never even went to such a possibility that some of the actors who were actually a part of that original series would become a part of what you were going to be creating.
You are exactly right. Oh, my goodness, Greg. I mean, when we were on set, you know, when we were actually on set in uniform with Mike Forrest in that gold outfit and the gold costume with the laurel leaves wreath around his head, there were several moments where I thought to myself, this is a dream. I mean, somebody pinch me, please. I'm standing here dressed in command gold talking to Apollo. I mean, it was all I could do to keep the 12-year-old inside of me from, you know, from just jumping out of my skin.
Wow.
And Mike, you know, when we would take a lunch break, we'd all sit around and have lunch together, and Mike would regale us with stories of his time on the original series and his interaction with Bill Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, and you know, it was just like euphoric. It was really hard to put into words how much fun and what a great privilege. And you want to hear the best part? Here's the best postscript to all of this, Greg. Even now, I mean, we shot that episode 3 years ago, okay? And we have since shot 4 more episodes with plenty of guest stars, Lou Ferrigno, Aaron Gray, Jamie Bamber, Doug Drexler, Colin Baker, The Sixth Doctor, Adrian Wilkinson, all these other guest stars. And yet, even now, when we get together on social occasions, we have dinner with our cast, when our cast and crew, when our STC family gets together in Los Angeles to have dinner or to socialize, Mike, Forrest, and Diana are there every time. My point is that we didn't just hire him and he came and did his role and left. We became dear friends. And even now, like literally, and I'm not joking, next Thursday, we are all going over to Mike and Diana's house for a social get together. We've done it dozens of times since that original episode was shot. So we've continued a wonderful, warm social friendship and relationship with Mike and Diana even after the episode was shot.
Explain to us, just to return to the nuts and bolts of something relatively mundane and yet absolutely essential. As we said towards the top, one of the stipulations for this being allowed to occur is that this cannot be a money-making operation. And yet it's an operation that involves, I should think, an enormous amount of money, although perhaps some of the people involved are donating certain services or are participating simply for the love of it. But certainly there are costs incurred, I'm guessing some significant costs incurred.
So
where does the money come from to make this possible? And how carefully do you have to be in terms of what money comes in and how you use it in order to not violate this agreement, which makes Star Trek Continues possible in the first place?
Great question. First of all, let me give you a perspective. In the original series, back in the late 60s, their budget per episode was about $110,000 per episode. Okay? Now, do you want to guess what that is in today's dollars?
A lot more.
It's over $1 million, Greg.
Wow.
I want you and your audience to process that for a minute. Consider that. To make the original series, to make an original series episode by today's money would be over $1 million, okay? Do you know how much we spend per episode?
I have no idea.
$60,000, maybe $70,000. Peanuts. Literally, peanuts to what it would normally cost to do this.
Hmm.
Now, the reason that is possible is because of all of the volunteers, because of people that are worth $1,200 or $1,500 a day, but they give of their time. And they give of their skills and their talent because they love what we're doing and they want to be a part of something special. Now, having said that, there are absolutely hard costs in making this happen. United Airlines doesn't give us free tickets just because, you know what I mean, we're not allowed to make money. Or hotels don't give us free rooms just because we're not allowed to make money. And restaurants don't give us free food. And fabric places don't give us free material to make uniforms and on and on. And, you know, movie production rental companies don't give us free dollies and lights and cameras. So there are hard costs involved with putting on a production like this. And those costs, as long as any money that is raised goes to the hard cost of production, it falls within, you know, the realm of, you know, of allowance, let's say. However, if we spend $70,000 to make an episode and there's $110,000 that's unaccounted for, you know what I mean? Then there's a suspicion of there being, you know, some kind of money being pocketed somewhere, you know, or somebody. And you know, I'm sure that happened. I mean, let's not kid ourselves, right? I mean, I'm sure there are people out there that have, you know, launched crowdfunding campaigns or raised money to do something. And the temptation when you've got that much money right in front of you is probably pretty great. But I can tell you, as God is my witness, that Star Trek Continues has endeavored, and we are in every way above board and are committed to being good stewards of the fans' donations. As I told you early on, I personally have spent probably $150,000 of my own savings to get this production off the ground. When I started, when I wanted to make this from the very beginning, my friends would say to me, well, why don't you launch a Kickstarter? And my response was, I don't feel that it's ethically right for me to ask people to give me money for something I've never proven I could do. And so I decided that the best thing for me to do would be to pay for the first one myself as a proof of concept, if you will. And if people like what they see, and they want to see more, then once I put my own money where my mouth is, and once we've actually made something and proven to people that we can do it and do it well, then we launch a crowdfunding campaign and ask people to help us.
I believe we're scheduled to rendezvous with the Potemkin.
Yes, sir. In under 4 hours.
Well, let's not keep them waiting. Lieutenant Uhura, contact them. Let them know we'll be lighting all the boilers, if that's all right with you, Mr. Scott.
As if you had to ask.
Mr. Chekov, set a course for Beta Aurigae.
Course laid in, sir.
Mr. Sulu, warp 6.
Yes, sir.
Vic Mignogna is the creator and executive producer of the web series Star Trek Continues. 5 episodes have been completed thus far. They are currently at work on a 6th. Mignogna hopes that he and his colleagues can complete a total of 13 episodes, the last of which would bridge the continuity gap between the end of the original series and the first of the major Star Trek films, Star Trek: The Motion Picture. You can watch all 5 episodes of Star Trek Continues on YouTube, or by going to their website, where you can also see behind-the-scenes footage, read their blog, and get donation information. The address is StarTrekContinues.com. My thanks to Vic Mignogna for joining me today on The Morning Show, and my thanks to WGTD colleague Jim McClure for helping arrange this interview. I'm Gregory Berg. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 24.